We're a radio station broadcasting from UBC Vancouver.
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
Visit CITR.ca.
Derek, it's just a...
I don't want to hear your excuses! The center has to be at least... 3 times bigger than this!
Welcome to the Community Living Show on the NCRA Radio Networks, the National Campus and Community Radio Association networks across Canada. And we only got one show in the west coast of Canada, which is in Vancouver, called CITR 101.9 FM and streaming online at CITR.ca. Co-op Radio is off to do its evergreen programming while they're moving from Wall Street over to Columbia and Hastings. So CITR is the only one that you'll get a chance to listen to us. I'm Kelly Rayburn. Along with me is Michael Cloggs. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Kelly.
That's good.
So we're here today with Morgane Auger, equality activist and politician. Morgane recently ran for MLA office for Vancouver's Foss Creek riding under the NDP, and I'm sure she's going to continue with her political career. Let's get to Morgan.
Yeah.
Hi, really nice to see you both today. Thanks for having me on.
It's our pleasure.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. So, one of the things, I guess, let's just get this over with, because people probably ask you this a lot. Are you one of BC's very first transgender politicians?
No, there have been other politicians that have tried to get elected in various roles in the 90s at the civics level. Someone has run. But I'm the first, I'm the first transgender candidate to have been put forward by a major party, like a national party, and the first one to have come so close. So I've come the closest to being elected that any transgender person has come in Canada at any level of government. For what that's worth, I guess what that means is that we're not quite there yet as a community. We haven't managed to get even one person elected to government in Canada. Mm-hmm. For the people who care about that. But we're getting close. You know, the last time I came within 415 votes out of 25,000-ish cast. And next time, if I run, I'm hoping to do better.
Yeah, I'm sure you will actually do better. Because you didn't lose by a lot. Yeah. And it was a really good fight. There was a couple recounts on Falls Creek, wasn't there?
Well, there was. The vote was close enough, and there were some issues in the countings and in the behaviors of a few individuals. And so there was a recount that was requested. Actually, we had asked for one, and it was turned down, but another candidate asked for a recount, and their request was agreed to. And then the absentee ballots, you know, the out-of-riding ballots, there were so many of those that it was possible that I could win in the absentee ballots. But in the end, we didn't close the gap enough. We closed it by one third, but that still didn't get me elected this time around. But yeah, it was really close. Election day was very emotional for me.
How did you get started just being in politics?
You know, I fell into politics. I really had a solid distrust of politicians. A well-earned one, I would say, for many politicians. Unfortunately. There's a long list of people who have been brought into public office and have let us down over the history of humanity. I came into politics because I was fighting for the equal treatment of transgender people, especially youth and students. in Canadian society. And when I came out, you know, I came out publicly in 2013, which is not that long ago, 4 years ago-ish. And back then, my, like, the condition, the situation of being transgender had just been depathologized recently. And so there was like a page turning in Canadian society where all of a sudden we were considered the same as everybody else, finally, after years of trying. And the discrimination was profound. I showed my face in 2013, and within a few months I had been attacked online, outed, and really treated very poorly by people who would consider people like me to be an abomination, or an attack on the status quo, I guess. And that really galvanized me. I guess I became a politician because I was deeply offended. And I was offended by how people use polite words behind smiling faces to apply their inborn biases. And I felt it personally and immediately as a transgender person, but very, very soon I started to really realize that actually discrimination is discrimination. And even though it affects different groups differently, ultimately, in its essence, it's the same. It's fear building on fear and causing the fear of the oppressed to stop them from living their lives to the fullest. And I promised myself I would address that, and I've been addressing it ever since. I've still been never paid to do it. That would be so nice. Isn't it funny how equity seeking communities are dying to be heard but can't get the help that we need, or even we were not treated seriously enough. But now I've ended up in politics where I've been able to affect policy. I'm very, very proud to have had a part to play in Bill C-16 that was just passed, which...
I saw you posted about that on Twitter, I think it was. Yeah. We follow each other on Twitter.
Exactly. I think it's what it is. Yeah, I was very vocal about Bill C-16. It's the federal law that was just passed that extends human rights protection, explicit human rights protection, against discrimination on the basis of gender identity or gender expression. And it also adds provisions in the criminal code to take into account hate crimes against transgender persons. And that was that built on the work that we did for the provincial level. Last year, we forced Christy Clark to do the same provincially we just made it impossible for her to say no. And so now I'm in politics. You know, these successes that we've had, I think we've had 8 major successes in a row. And now I'm trying to actually come into politics and help address more injustices.
Yeah. Well, you're actually showing that being in politics doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have an elected position to have a change on our society.
That's right. You know, people underappreciate how powerful their voice is. You know, now that said, there's lots of people who stand on top of a hill with a flag saying, I want this to happen, and that never works, right? But if they build a community of like-minded people, and even better, if they get people who have nothing to gain from that position to support them and to say, you know what, this is the right thing to do. We want that to happen. They can make change. Major changes can be done. And the secret, of course, is to getting government or getting an MLA or an MP on your side to advocate for you and to be your voice in this hollowed space, which is the legislature. Yeah. And then from there on, you can actually go forward and you can actually be heard. And all that it really takes is a little bit of discipline and a clear idea of what you're looking for. And there are organizations that train you. You know, I was trained by the United Way, of all places. The United Way has a program called the Public Policy Institute, and that's where I learned how to convince a politician or a lawmaker or a decision maker to do what I want them to do. And I think we owe a lot to that program. That I was accepted in that program delivered an awful lot of results for the trans community in Canada.
That's pretty impressive. I would never look to the United Way for such a resource.
I know, right? We wouldn't have thought that the United Way was so active in training future advocates. And this specific program is very, very good. And it also gives you really good connections. And so you come out of it with 25 peers. You know, there's about 25 people per cohort. Mm-hmm. You've had a chance. You know, this is where I met Mike Harcourt, who we still laugh today about the fact that on the first day that I met him, he recommended that I drop the advocacy for trans human rights because that was an unwinnable battle. And in his view, it was impossible to win. Right. Or it would be so difficult that I should find something easier as my first challenge. And so never say no to me, apparently, is his what he took from it. But it's such a powerful tool, this program.
There's still a lot of work to be done especially globally. I've been involved with programs involving the Foundation of Hope and all like that, too, where I've gone out and photographed Strutt and other things that the Foundation of Hope has done, trying to get this to go worldwide. And along the way, I think it's called Kaleidoscope. I think it's one of the activists was former cast member of Doctor Who.
Oh.
Yeah.
Cool.
John Barrowman.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm terrible with celebrity names. I got the Doctor Who part, the rest of it I lost. The Foundation of Hope is brilliant. There are a few organizations in the LGBT advocacy space, you know, that are these grown-up groups now. There's Foundation of Hope. There's the ARC Foundation, which tried to work with large organizations.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the Foundation of Hope, which does so much work with rainbow refugees. There's also the Rainbow Railroad, I believe they're called, which I don't want to call it the pleasure, but I had the fortune of interacting with this year on a very difficult subject matter. There was an emergency intervention that we did right in the middle of the election. There were three Iranian LGBT refugees being extradited from Turkey extrajudicially, and through help from the Rainbow Railroad and Amnesty International and the UNHCR, we managed to stop that. And I was really impressed by the responsiveness of the Rainbow Railroad, that they're very high quality organization.
You know, even with that being said, that all this work that we had to do around the world, just in our own backyard, there's still lots of weeds to be pulled to getting people to understand that people of all genders or gender IDs need to be recognized.
Absolutely. And in other communities as well. You know, I think it's disingenuous to not acknowledge that there are other communities that are also profoundly oppressed in BC and in Canada, the First Nations communities, the Métis community, racialized newcomers, especially racialized asylum seekers, you know, refugees, really struggle in Canada to come into our society. In BC, we see that. I think the way I like to look at it is I try to look at the claims of discrimination against organizations like the police, you know, the Human Rights Tribunal, keeping a track of who the complainants are and what the issues are is always a really good indicator of where injustice happens. You know, persons with disability, racialized persons, LGBT people, mostly transgender people these days, you know, discrimination against someone on sexual orientation is pretty passé in BC. You have to look hard to find actual discrimination against adults. But against children, it's a different story. Youth, right? You know, we have a major problem with LGBT youth suicide in British Columbia and in Canada. I try to look at all of these demographics that are struggling and try to identify why this bias is affecting them, which bias it is, and why it's affecting these people, and if there's anything that can be done. And usually there is, and most of the time it's education and enforcement, the two things that go together so well. You educate the caregivers in the communities, and you put some teeth to policies, and you make sure that the miscreants get punished through their own acts. You know, myself, during the election, I had to deal with this Bill Watcott, who was putting out flyers about questioning my identity. You know, we've since I've put in a human rights claim with the Human Rights Tribunal to see if he, to ask for protection from such behavior. You know, the publishing of hate speech or hateful material as a fact, rather than as you know, the opinions of someone who's out on a limb of credibility, let's call it. And hopefully that claim will get through the Human Rights Tribunal with the outcome that I expect. And I hope to see other people stand up and to say, you know what, this was unfair. This thing that happened to me, whoever that person is, wasn't fair. And I want to step up, and I want to step up, and I want to do something about it.
Well, that's one of the reasons why Kelly and I keep this soapbox going.
Uh-huh.
It's like we try to make it so that, you know, if there's an injustice, you know, we specialize in disabilities, but we try to keep it so that if there's an injustice being done, that we can talk about it, and we luckily we have that ability. Here in Canada to talk about freely about injustices.
Absolutely. Luckily we do. And luckily we're pretty good in Canada about sharing information.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as I've told everybody else, if there's any information I can share from my own fight against injustice based on gender identity, if there's any facts I can share for people who are fighting injustice against disability, or injustice against racialization, I'm available. You know, I have a phone number they can call. It's 604-398-3982. That's my campaign office phone that we've kept going. They can call and reach me, and we can have a chat about whether or not they have a human rights claim and what they should do. It's really intimidating, right? This thing when people have been hurt and say, you know, somebody was speaking to me yesterday. I was, you know, saying I was creatively fired because my employer hates French people. That was basically this feeling that this person had, and we had to talk about it. And in the end, it was like, unfortunately, it sounds like your creative firing might have been caused by that, but you have no evidence. The evidence part is the hardest, right? Can you show something?
That was one place I was employed with. I actually held the smoking gun, and that it could have been because racially activated, and I turned it down. I was like, no, we're not gonna. I didn't throw the car because I didn't. The lawyer told me that it was there,
mm-hmm.
but I said, no, I know these guys. It's not it.
There's a difference between banter and stupidity and mm-hmm. bias, that biased action. Everybody has, you know, put their foot in their mouth in their statements.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a difference between saying something dumb and not meaning it, and then an action.
Right.
Usually sometimes you have to, you know, find an action, right? And mm-hmm. it's clear. We can all, every one of us who suffers from vulnerability to a bias, we can tell when there's been an action of bias, right? People who walk by you and plug their nose and they don't want to have anything to do with you because they don't like the likes of you, whoever that is, or the people who look away, or the people who stare, or whatever, that's human nature in a way. I will never not be stared at, for example, because of who I am. And some people are so shocked, right? Mm. I once enjoyed, I was in Abbotsford at a white spot, and I went in with one of my children to have a bite on the way back from a ski resort in the interior, and it was like I guess it was licensed, and they had a little bit of a bar, and a gentleman was drinking a beer, and he actually missed his beer drink and poured his beer on his lap as I walked in the door with my child to go and have to feed my child, right?
Oh, dear.
You know, I'll never get around that.
Yeah.
Everybody who has a visible disability or who is visibly racialized or is othered somehow will never get away from that, the human nature, and it's troubling, and it can mess with our, you know, mojo sometimes, right? But in the end, we can't get away from that. But if that person who did that were to get up and complain to the managers that I was there and have the managers come to me and tell me, I'm sorry, I can't serve you, that would be an action. Right. And an action is discrimination.
Right.
The bias, everybody's allowed to have bias, but to act on bias, that's the thing.
I like how you put that, because dribbling a beer, okay, nothing wrong with that. But having you kicked out of the restaurant, that's...
That would be an egregious human rights infraction, and I would crucify them for that.
Yeah, I think there was a restaurant chain that actually was successfully sued over racial bias.
I wouldn't be surprised. If the bias is an action and if the action is documented, then there's no protection.
Yeah.
You know, the protection is not that was a bad apple. The protection is not we didn't realize. The protection is not we didn't mean it or we've changed our ways. You know,
right.
You know, an action is an action. That's all there is to it. And you just need one.
You're tuned in to the Community Living Show on the NCRE Radio Networks. We're going to come right back with our guest, Morgan Ojai, who was the NDP candidate for Vancouver Falls Creek. Again, we're going to take a break, and we will be back with more on the interview. I am Kelly Rayburn on the controls, and we'll be back in a moment. The Global Accessibility Awareness Day is on the third Thursday of May of each year. The community and campus stations across Canada are hosting exclusive radio about accessibility, self-advocacy, adaptive technology, and more. For more information, contact your local stations about the National Access Day.
Liveband.com is Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar. New shows are added daily by the city's most active promoters, musicians, and by the driving force of the music scene, the fans. Liveband.com's listings are different because they are integrated with profiles updated by bands and business owners as they promote upcoming events. Check out the archives to see how closely we've worked within the community to put on the shows you love. Visit LiveMusicVancouver.com for the latest independent and major label event listings. LiveVan.com, Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar.
Your cell phone already has an FM receiver chip installed in it, but major Canadian telecommunication and mobile companies have blocked access to this free system to listen to the radio in favor of charging for data streaming. With access to the FM chip, your phone can still receive broadcasts and updates during an emergency, even if the cell towers are down. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
Welcome back to the Community Living Show on the NCRE Radio Networks. We're talking to Morgan Ojai, the NDP candidate for the Vancouver Falls Creek area. I'm going to send it over to Michael, and he'll start talking with Morgan.
Yeah, I like what you said about there having to be a definite action, and so far we've talked about nonviolent actions. What do you think should be done when there is a violent action, say somebody is attacked physically attacked or beaten up over being marginalized?
That's a criminal act. Mm-hmm. You know, assault begins at touching. So if I touch someone because I don't like something inherent to who they are based on their identity, right? Whether it's because, identity being, you know, either who they were born as or who they are at the moment. You know, if I touch them non-consensually, that's an assault. As soon as we go into assault, we get into criminal. The criminal code is its own animal. It's a separate law. It's criminal code and human rights code or acts, depending on the jurisdiction, are two different sets of laws, different sets of tests. Right, in the criminal law doesn't do such a good job of punishing people for being bigots, right? Acting on bias, but they do take into account bias when there's judgment. So if there's an assault, if there's an assault against an individual, and that turns out to bring in criminal charges, then if it's bias driven, then at sentencing, there is extra consideration being put in for punishment. So in the end, the biased behavior when it comes to, you know, altercations that are physical, things that cause injury, those things, what happens is the bias informs the decisions on the judge on how to act from there. But you still have to prove that there was this person and all of these things. And criminal convictions are, you know, much harder to get. It's the test is higher for whether or not you can prove this person did it and whether or not you can prove that it was bias-driven. Right. Generally speaking, so there's also... So that's from the crime aspect, right?
Right.
Was this crime bias-driven? If a crime is proven to be bias-driven, generally speaking, you know, speaking as a non-lawyer, generally speaking, really the only outcome is that the punishment is more severe.
Okay.
That's really what it is. In the human rights world, set of laws, whether it's Federal Human Rights Act or Provincial Human Rights Code, we don't... Like, these laws don't deal with physical altercations. They deal with the refusal of services,
mm-hmm.
or the publishing of information that incites others to discriminate. That's basically the places that we work. Now, it is true in the criminal code, there's something about hate speech, you know, like inciting others to genocide.
Right.
I think inciting others to genocide is a pretty serious thing to claim against someone, right? And I think that, you know, for those kinds of questions, by the time you get there, well, you've already gotten somewhere serious and you've already lawyered up.
Yeah,
most likely.
Well, genocide is one of the reasons why Canada right now has taken in so many of the Syrian immigrants or refugees.
Somewhat, yes. I think some of it is genocide and some of it is just war.
Yeah.
You know. The risk of war.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important to appreciate that generally speaking, you know, the Human Rights Code does not protect you against someone being a jerk. People can still be jerks. And it's jerkiness is protected to a point.
Yes.
Right? But acting, their actions, for example, publishing a book about how you're a horrible person, or in my case with this complaint, the idea of that they went around and published a poster and put a poster all over a neighborhood talking about me and making wild statements about me. That is an action.
Right.
Right? The actions, of course, are, that's not just hurting feelings.
Yeah. We still call that defamation?
I'd have to look it up and ask a lawyer specifically.
But, yeah. But... But I'm sure in either direction, when somebody publicly slams you and there's no truth or the basis is for again, biased, there's always cause to bring...
You're not allowed to knowingly say something that isn't true. And as a matter of fact, you're not allowed to say things about people that aren't true.
Mm-hmm.
There's libel and there's slander. One is if you write it and one is if you speak it. And then essentially, my understanding is that, if somebody says something mean about you, that's one thing. But if someone lies about you, it's something else.
Right.
And, you know, and so this is back to like this jerk test, right?
Yeah.
You know, is this person being a jerk or is this person actually being harmful?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't get to just say whatever you want in Canada. We have constraints on free speech, right? We're not the U.S. People often mistake the whatever amendment, First Amendment or whatever, Second Amendment, the U.S. free speech rule, which in the U.S., the right of free speech is almost absolute. In Canada, it's profoundly mitigated. There's many things you don't get to say.
I was born in the U.S., There are a lot of mitigations that if you say things just the right way, there's a consequence to come out of it. Or if a negative result comes solely against a certain person, there's probably something to be said about it,
mm-hmm.
legally or however.
Right. Where it matters more.
You can't be harmful.
That's right. So where it's more, so in Canada, generally speaking, when we talk about human rights, we talk about organizations. an organization, like, so a nurse in a hospital, for example, isn't acting as an individual.
She's representing part of a whole, right?
Part of a whole. She's part of a machine. Or a police officer. Right?
Yes.
A police officer. You know, when so I've done a lot of work with Vancouver Police Department, again, on, based on anti-transgender discrimination, because the VPD was found guilty of ongoing and systemic discrimination against transgender people and they were found guilty of that in 2015, and in my opinion, they have not yet actually completely resolved the situation. We're hoping it'll be resolved this month, but it's still, you know, outstanding.
Yeah.
And you know, in the many, many conversations that have come around that, the issue of we have a few bad apples in this large police force, and in my position has always been, you know what, I don't care if you have bad apples. That is your organizational problem. You hired those bad apples, and you pay them. And if you don't act to fix the bad apples, you knowingly keep them there, and you have to sort out your own problems. They're not my community's problems, just like they're not, the fact that Vancouver Police doesn't understand certain communities because they don't have representatives that understand those communities is not that community's problem. It's Vancouver Police's problem.
Then they should find a way to gain the representation and the understanding that onus is on them.
Correct. And remembering that Vancouver Police Department works for the Attorney General and the Minister of Justice, ultimately, and the Minister of Justice decides what the standards of delivery of policing are. And we decided who the Ministry of Justice is going to be. And therefore, ultimately, Vancouver Police Department's bad apples are the responsibility of you and I as citizens. We tolerate their bad apples as a society, as voters.
That's an important point. Because recently on the show, we did actually, it was a mental health arrest. So and also it was a mistaken identity where this young lady was pinned by the RCMP at, I believe it was the Newton Bus Exchange.
Yeah. I'm familiar with this case.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of people, but we actually broadcasted the soundbite. Mm-hmm. And as a society, if we don't step up and say, this cannot happen anymore, then that falls back. If we don't actively keep after it, then it falls back on us.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. If we hire the police in a way to be, you know, sometimes to be the big guys with sticks. Right?
Yeah.
And they have procedures. Mm-hmm. And the procedures have been allowed. And if we don't like their procedures, we can put pressure. And because we own them, right? And they are our thugs with sticks at that moment where they're acting like a thug with sticks. And it's important for us to realize that, because when we realize that, actually we can direct our anger at that person who pins someone down and behaves badly. True. It's possible that that person broke rules, but actually what we should do is go up the food chain up to the place where there's political risk,
right?
The place where they answer to us, because VPD or the police people or a soldier doesn't answer to us as individuals. They answer to their masters. Their masters answer to voters. And those people are susceptible to things like public relations nightmares. They're susceptible to press. They're susceptible to petitions.
Right.
You know, if the government in power, it's about to be the government that I'm with the NDP, right? We're about to take over power. If the police misbehave on our watch, let's say, or the NDP government's watch, then pressure needs to be put on the NDP government. But that pressure needs to be fact-based, right? Because this is the problem. There's always a lot of complaining about everything, but we need the essence of the complaint in order to do something about it. And I'm very happy to help anybody get to the essence. But we can't just be screaming at government all the time that does nothing.
Well, what do you think Is training one of the big issues?
I think policy? It is. You know, I often try to explain to activists, especially radical activists, the ones that are just never, unless I get everything I want, that we'll never accomplish anything by bringing a group of people with the same belief system in a space with signs to chant and yell and ask for something. That is never going to accomplish anything unless we also have a few leaders or a few bridge builders that go and build the bridges with the people who can make those decisions and whose job is to explain to the decision makers why it's in their best interest to do what is being asked. And this is always a thing that is lost. How do you tell a decision maker that has to make many, many decisions and can never look in detail why this one ask is important? And sadly, at government, those asks, the answer usually have to do with money, right? Money or votes.
Right.
Do this because it'll make you popular, or do that because it'll save you money or earn money. And it's the language of policy. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we pay for healthcare? We pay for healthcare by making these decisions, for example, that investing in this therapy reduces that cost.
Right.
Right? We want to, you know, I'm just using healthcare as an example because we're all familiar with it.
But it's a very truthful example.
That's right. We want to believe that if there's a new treatment, then we will use it. Mm-hmm. But I can give you an example. Like currently, surgical care in BC is saturated. Mm-hmm. If you want to add a kind of surgery, you have to take away a kind of surgery because there's no more room in the operating theaters, mm-hmm. or at least in a lot of these hospitals. And so if this is true, right, if there's only so much money or if there's only so much resource or if you have to build a new hospital or something like this, you're talking that, you know, if you have to wait until the new St. Paul's Hospital is built to add a therapy, you're talking about a 10-year wait, right? And that's all there is to it. For example,
the hospital thing, they're building a new St. Paul's Hospital, but they're taking away the old St. Paul's Hospital and there won't be anything left.
That's right. And this is the problem when a society says at the same time, we want more stuff, but we don't want to pay for it.
Right.
This is always a problem, right? If we really do, like, you know, if we're telling our lawmakers and the people who govern, we want more healthcare, we want more education, right? Mm-hmm. Pay for better education, but don't raise taxes, then the inevitable is either more efficient or less of something else. Right. There's only two ways to do it, right? And then if we say, well, we want you to raise taxes, well, the whole province had better be on the same page about that, right? Yeah. Because chances are they're not, and someone else is saying, oh, you're raising my taxes for no reason.
Okay, let's look at that, because we do have a situation where that is true. The road tax has been increased. They call it a toll, a bridge toll. Mm-hmm. And if I cross the living in Surrey, I cross the wrong bridge, I have to pay an extra road tax.
That's really unfair, isn't it?
Right.
Why that bridge?
We weren't all on board with that. Mm-hmm. So,
why that bridge? Why not that other bridge?
Right.
How do you do that? Is this a highway? So yeah. I used to have a business on the Sunshine Coast, mm-hmm. and I used to take the Sunshine Coast ferry to Langdale all the time, like once or twice mm-hmm. a week.
Right.
And I really noticed how I was paying for that part of the highway,
right?
that ferry part, which was, of course, BC Ferries was funded on the premise that it was highway, and so people built yeah. communities and things like this. We took away a steamship system, which was reasonably inexpensive, and then which delivered you to, you know, all of the centers, mm-hmm. and then replaced it with a ferry system that requires roads and driving. And then we raised and raised and raised and raised the price of the ferry.
Right.
Just like the tolls.
Yeah.
What do we do? Do we do road pricing? Do we do tolls? I am very happy that I don't have to have the decision because right. I'm not elected. But it's, yeah, fairness is very important.
Yeah, but well, that's the thing is if everybody doesn't believe that any type of taxing is fair, you're going to have a pushback.
So
like, so
so user pay is also mm-hmm. unfair, right?
Yeah.
You don't want people who have a specific need to pay for that specific need, because the beauty of a government or of a large population yeah. is you spread the risk. Mm-hmm. And that way you don't you know, this way you don't have to hedge against every risk, because everybody's paying into your roads, everybody pays into your ambulance, everybody pays into your city maintenance, and everybody pays into your health care, and that way whatever the one is you need is there for you.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you're tuned in to the Community Living Show on the National Campus and Radio Networks, and we're only doing one radio station. That's on CITR 101.9 FM and streaming online at CITR.ca. We're not doing Co-op Rio because of their move from Powell Street to Columbia, and Hastings is on the move, so they're doing their Evergreen Drive, so we're not doing the show on this show. So it's only for CITR, so... And again, I'm Kelly, and along with me is Michael. We'll be back again after the break, so keep us locked in on the Community Living Show. Stay with us. The Global Accessibility Awareness Day is on the third Thursday of May of each year. The community and campus stations across Canada are hosting exclusive radio about accessibility, self-advocacy, adaptive technology, and more. For more information, contact your local stations about the National Access Day.
Become a CITR member and make some new friends. Members get discounts on Main Street at
Hot Art, Wet City, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, East Vanity Parlor, The Wallflower and Modern Diner, RX Comics, Dandelion Records and Emporium, The Rag Machine, Neptune Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Book Warehouse, On the French Hair Design, Red Cat Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, True Value Vintage, and I Found Gallery, and the Biltmore Cabaret.
What would we do without our friends?
Crimes and Treasons Radio, this is Riff Raff. Every Tuesday from 9 to 11 p.m. on 101.9 FM with Relly Rails and Jules Andre Brown.
This is the Community Living Show on the National Campus and Radio Association Networks. I'm, of course, Kelly Rayburn, and along with Michael Rubin across from me, and we have a special guest from Vancouver False Creek NDP candidate, Morgan Oje. Now, before the break, you mentioned about the steamships on the BC ferries, how it used to be kind of expensive and stuff, and then, you know, as time goes on, you know, the hike of the ferries go higher and higher. Now BC Ferries is now introducing LNG, liquefied natural gas, and the provincial government is encouraging, well, this was back when BC Liberal government, when Christy Clark was around, doing the LNG mm-hmm. production, while we had to deal with, you know, the Kinder Morgan trans pipelines and all sorts of energy groups. What do you think of the provincial government's LNG plan?
You mean the whole LNG plan of the Christy Clark government?
Yeah.
My opinion is that I can only see one person that's been hired for all of that, and that's been someone who was there to do public relations for LNG. I come from an engineering background, okay. And I value the fact that you, in order to run a society, you need every industry.
Right.
You need to produce energy, things like this. Mm-hmm. I believe that a region that is rich in a resource does well by using it.
Right.
I also believe that we need to watch our carbon footprint and not be reckless.
Right.
Right. I do believe, for example, that there are some things that cannot today sidestep CO2 production. For example, peak load energy production, mm-hmm. which is exactly what a motor is, right?
Right.
Produces energy, just motion, movement energy. like in a ferry. So if we're going to have ferries, or if we're going to have, I don't know, rail cars that are not, if we're going to move stuff by rail that's not on an electrified track, then we would be better off using locally produced fuel than using imported fuel, even if it's imported from Alberta, right? Mm. So, sure. Nonetheless, we would also be even better off by using only electrified equipment that comes from a grid that's fed by renewable resources that mm-hmm. That don't have a carbon footprint, and that would be that much better. So what do I think? I think that there's no way around some energy infrastructure that moves CO2-generating fuels, mm-hmm. like LNG and so forth. But, you know, consuming your own LNG is different than exporting LNG. But ultimately, in the end, should we prevent someone from exporting LNG? I'm not sure about that. I am sure, however, that we shouldn't subsidize it, right? And we shouldn't blow enormous amounts of provincial budget to subsidize an industry that is not carbon neutral, or even worse, that is harmful. And I would like to see way more information about LNG's contribution to society before I believed it. And on top of that, let's not forget that the LNG market has collapsed and all justification for LNG exports have fallen apart, as far as I can tell. So ignoring, even if we ignore our social responsibility to our grandchildren, let's say we close our eyes to that, and we shouldn't, we still can't close our eyes to the fact that today developing LNG seems to be a reckless financial decision. And we shouldn't make reckless financial decisions, or at least not subsidize them with our public funds.
Yeah. There's a couple other seismic issues with fracking.
That's part of the recklessness aspect as well. That's right.
So,
absolutely.
So something to be considered, right?
So, you know, I was born in France, and in France, in whole regions of France, fracking is banned. It's not allowed. And, you know, it's alarming to see the stories coming out of the U.S. where they get they're drinking water mixed in with natural gas, methane gas, and things like this. And there are so many better sources of energy than LNG.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there's also the Site C dam as well.
Right. So Site C dam, you know, the position of the NDP when we were running a campaign was that we want to, you know, we will, as soon as we take power, the NDP is going to put Site C Dam for review by the BC Utilities Commission to see what they think. The problem is the Site C Dam is already under construction. It's already well on its way. And there have already been significant environmental consequences of that construction project. So now we have to, like, revisit and ask ourselves, what's the better road? Is the better road to stop? Is the better road to stop and undo all the damage? Or is the better road to just grit our teeth and finish because we're so far along already? And I have to be honest, I have no idea what the answer is. But sometimes pragmatic decisions are more important than ideological ones. Sometimes the damage has already been done. And I don't know what the situation with Site C. I really look forward to the Utilities Commission bringing its report back. My understanding is that the financial justifications aren't there to build Site C Dam. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that every attempt we've had to build up heavy industry in the north seemed to have failed, you know, decade after decade.
Right.
The smelters, you know, the Alcan smelters, I don't believe are running anymore. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't remember, but at Kitimat, right? So there's... Yeah. The justification this time around is LNG, but that I can tell we're not going to build that stuff up there,
right?
Or certainly not in the next 10-20 years. Let's do a little bit better planning and a little bit less nepotism and graft. I would like to see I would love to know if the decision remains unchanged, if the decision is being made by a body that didn't get funded by LNG contractors and heavy industry construction contractors. Mm-hmm. I have to say that, you know, in this election campaign, I was dismayed by the correlation between BC Liberal decisions and who paid for their campaign. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's really troubles me. I really do not believe that corporate or union interests should be allowed to fund politics. I think that at least unions have a little bit of transparency and moral value, that they are an aggregate of individuals who are contributing a little bit towards the best interests of individuals. Mm-hmm. But even there, I'm not so sure. I think I would have much preferred to see election campaigns with a fixed budget and a very, very well-controlled campaign contribution, including third-party advertising. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I wonder how decisions like Site C or ferries or pulp mill openings and mine openings and closures, how those would happen if we had a government that really actually looked after our best interests only.
Mm-hmm. There's another interesting mine closures. It's like when they close a mine, they just leave the mess. And
I think people should go to prison for that.
I think if
you run a business that creates more damage than the mine, than the business paid for the public, the people responsible, every CEO that touched those decisions should face, 10 years in prison. Mm. 10 years in a high security prison. Let's see how they change their ways. No. I do like the idea of criminal liability for financial misdeeds. just in the same way that we have malpractice, or forcing them to have malpractice insurance, forcing the mine to pay for malpractice insurance and to carry a $20 billion rider from Lloyd's Insurance for 50 years and to see how that goes for them, right?
Right.
Or force them to clean up their own act. I would like to see mining companies and primary resource companies and everybody that touches our environment to do a little bit better, a drastically better job of policing themselves with consequences from the outside. If you don't police yourselves, your insurance rates will go up because we're going to force insurance.
The thing is, back globally again with the mining industry, it isn't just in North America that they have left these messes. They've gone into countries that are so small, have such small economies that people can barely feed themselves, and they rape and pillage, and it is leave the mess where no one can actually use the land again.
That's true. Social responsibility for your actions is at a global level now, right?
Yeah.
Hey, I don't know. Make it that any company, it's a problem, right? There's no doubt it's a problem.
There isn't a one word answer for it, but it does lead back into what you're doing with being an activist for human rights.
That's right. I think environmental justice is very complex. Mm-hmm. And there's always this tinge of hypocrisy in there. We are very, very conscious of environmental justice when it comes to the things that are obvious, like, a big mound of radioactive waste. That's unjust, right? But then we're not at all, we all participate in consuming that stuff. Mm-hmm. Right? We all wear polymer and animal-based clothing, right? We consume food that we don't want to think about the treatment of that chicken or what was put onto that plant or the farm workers that touched the chemicals that went to keep insects down or predators down. Yet we don't put laws that enforce our sentiment. We don't say, you know what? You can't sell unethically raised animals, products in Canada. Some countries do that, right? Some countries do that.
Well, the thing is, if we were actually to do that, all of the factory farms that are out there would probably be shut down.
You can, you know, this is a question of affordability. I know there's this democratization of food as well, which is an important thing. You can't, it's also unfair to demand expensive food production when people in your society can't pay for it. I find that, I remember, so I spent a decade in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And then I moved back to Canada in 2009. And I remember to my shock seeing that the same quality of food here, you had to go to Whole Foods or to Urban Fair to buy, and you bought it at a significant premium compared to what you bought in a grocery store in Zurich. Mm. And the reason why it was in Zurich, they had laws that said everybody, like, they have a rule about if you're going to eat beef, the beef has to have been raised within 20 minutes of where it was killed. You couldn't transport animals long distances. You want to raise, you know? But of course, this is a very small country. But the outcome of that is these animals were, you know, they didn't go through stresses and things like this. They weren't factory farmed and things like this.
But I'm assuming these are all local products.
They ended up being all local products. Yeah. That's right. And it's a country that has high wages and then encourages local product consumption and has laws to back it up. For example, in Switzerland, an animal that is slaughtered has to be anesthetized first, as an example. And but that's like, it's a rich country. It's a small country. And everybody, the minimum wages in Switzerland are quite high. Whereas in, let's say, in the European Union or in Canada, the majority of people can't afford to access food like this if it's available. Because it's well outside of the price ranges of people's ability to feed themselves. So where do you draw that line about, you know, ethics and accessibility of things? Food has to be accessible. Food is made accessible by price, either by making more money, like earning more money for everybody, or less expensive food. If it's a quandary.
Yeah.
Like everything, it's a quandary. I think this is what really interested me in politics. I enjoy the quandaries, and I like that things are multivariable, and I think it's always fascinating to decide as a society, well, which way do we want to go with this? We decide, after all of us in BC, we decided BC politics, all of us in Canada decide which way Canada should go, and we should make more decisions.
Now that the provincial elections pretty much finish, what's on the horizon for you?
That's a good question. I'm going back into industry for a while. So I'm going to work. Mm-hmm. I'm a software worker. I'm an entrepreneur / worker in the software industry.
Right.
So working in tech most likely for a while. I'm hoping that this legislature stands for a while. It would be lovely to see it go for 4 years.
It'd be nice.
But in case it doesn't, I'm ready.
Okay.
I'm ready to present myself for another election at any time.
Right.
And we're, no matter what, we're preparing. So whoever ends up running in Vancouver Falls Creek in the next election will be prepared. We'll have, you know, the table will have been set for them to sit and go. But then I'm hoping that's me. But democracy, you know, it's complex. And it has to be listened to, otherwise it's not a democracy. There's a federal election coming in 2 years?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's in 2 years?
Yeah, in October.
And now I'm watching the preparations for the civic, you know, the municipal election?
Yeah.
I've had a lot of encouragement to present myself in the provincial election, and I've resisted it.
Right.
I'm really interested in the laws that affect people. And in helping shape laws, I'm also, it's true, I have to say, I'm quite interested in the things that include standards of living, quality of life, things that touch civics. Mm. you know, in municipal decision making. Mm-hmm. But right now, I think I'm focusing on provincial. And I think this is where I'm going to concentrate for the next while, unless someone changes my mind.
All right. So that was the interview that we did on the Community Living Show. Sorry it takes so long, but you have been listening to the Community Living Show on the NCRA Radio Networks and also on CITR 101.9 FM. Coming up, we've got some upcoming shows that are coming to you right now on CITR 101.9 FM. But thank you very much for tuning in, and we'll see you all next week. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Snatches of music, whole orchestras play inside our heads.
And then it explodes into this enormous collage of what this present moment looks like, what it feels like, and what it sounds like. It explodes into this enormous collage. And in this moment, we are perfect, perfect. We are whole.
It appears rather gruesome, wrinkles like a walnut, and with the consistency of mushroom.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Particles and Waves on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory in Vancouver at the University of British Columbia. My name is Mia. This show is an eclectic music program that runs for the next hour. And as I sent a message to a friend of mine earlier today that most of my shows are pretty good, and I feel pretty good to awesome about the lineup. This show is one of the ones that, you know, elicited like 3 okay sign emojis in a row. It's such a great lineup. I'm really, really looking forward to sharing it with all of you. So why don't we just get started with Lydia Ainsworth. Lydia Ainsworth is a Toronto artist. She, I've played her a bunch before. She just released an album called Darling of the Afterglow just a few months ago, and I was listening to it just sort of on the periphery. I really enjoyed the opening track, which is called The Road. There's a very, very good cover of Chris Isaacs's Wicked Game on there that it just is so much better than it has any right to be, but in the past couple of weeks, I started listening to Darling of the Afterglow seriously and, you know, kind of put it on while I was doing something and let it play all the way through and just fell head over heels in Gaga level love. This is going to be one of my favorite albums of the year, I think. It's a very dark, moody, electronic sort of sound that is very, very powerful and I really, really enjoy. So I want to play a track that I've really just been, it's been on repeat a lot, called What Is It by her. It makes use of, you know, for all that it is dark and ambient and moody and electronic, it makes use of of some very, very unique instrumentation toward the bridge. A banjo should not be able to fit into all of those words, but it does, and it does very, very well. So I really hope you enjoy that. I've also got new tracks from Beach Fossils and Roco Code after that, and so much more. So please enjoy this, the first set of today's Particles and Waves.